Welcome to the Weekly Leadership Experience, a place for leaders to get inspired, be challenged, and grow. I am your host, Rashad Oberlander. Let's get started. Today's episode of the Weekly Leadership Experience is brought to you by my 7-day Leadership Growth Challenge. It's a free challenge that I've created, and it's delivered by email over the course of 7 days. I've created 7 compelling questions to challenge various aspects of your leadership, the way you lead, and why you lead. Go to rashadoberlander.com and scroll down until you find the 7-day leadership challenge, or look for the link in the show notes. And now, on with the show. Hello, leaders. Welcome to this week's episode. I'm honored to be joined today by Michael Bungay Stanier. Michael is best known for his best-selling book, The Coaching Habit, which has sold close to 1 million copies. The Coaching Habit promises to teach you to stay curious a little longer and change the way you lead forever. For me, Michael has certainly delivered. His latest book, The Advice Trap, focuses on what it takes to tame your advice monster and is a follow-up to The Coaching Habit. Michael is the founder of Box of Crayons, a learning and development company that helps organizations move from advice-driven to curiosity-led. They've trained hundreds of thousands of managers to be more coach-like, and their clients range from Microsoft to Gucci. Michael left Australia about 30 years ago to be a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University, where, in his own words, his only significant achievement was falling in love with a Canadian, which is why he now lives in Toronto, having spent time in London and Boston. Michael, it is an honor and a privilege to welcome you to the Weekly Leadership Experience.
You know, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm happy to have you, and thank you for agreeing to chat with me today.
Sure.
Michael, I always like to start with a bit of the origin story. Can you share a little bit about your story and what led you to write The Coaching Habit and The Advice Trap?
Sure. Well, idiocy is what makes you write a book, because writing a book is a terrible experience for almost anybody, even somebody who can write books. Like, I've written books before, but it's always hard. So you always have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? If you kind of hit the rewind button and go all the way back. So, born in Australia, I'm 52, I think now, 52. So grew up in Canberra, the national capital, happy life, great parents, good brothers. School, high school, university in Canberra. I did what's known as an arts law degree in Australia. So it's like 2 degrees for the price of 1.5. So I did a BA in literature and a law degree, which is undergraduate degree in Australia. What happens when you do a law degree is it's really hard to rise above sunk cost, because you're like, I've got a law degree now. I may as well do the next step to become a lawyer. And then you become a lawyer, and then you're like, well, sunk cost. I may as well try and become a deputy partner. And then you go, well, I may as well try and become a partner. And that's why there's so many unhappy lawyers. I was saved from that fate by winning a Rhodes Scholarship, took me to Oxford, stopped me being a lawyer, amazing, met my wife, amazing. So I didn't go back to Australia, which was the very loose plan, and took my first job in England, eventually got to the States, where we lived for a few years in Boston. My wife is a Boston Bruins fan, so that was great for her. And then moved to Toronto in 2001. I had a job lined up as a kind of organizational consultant, but 9/11 happened. In fact, the day we were supposed to leave Boston is when 9/11 happened.
Wow.
And it meant that when we finally did make it across the border, my job had vanished, and it was very unclear what I was going to be doing now, because kind of all consulting jobs had vanished. Everybody was, you know, traumatized, and business kind of shuddered to a halt. In the end, shortly after that, I started my own company. It's something that I'd been kind of trending towards as I became increasingly unemployable and disliked by my bosses. And, you know, it's one of the great... Some people are called to being an entrepreneur because they're like, I want money. Some people are called because they want control. And for me, I'm like, you know what? I don't like having bosses. I'm not that good at being subservient or being a small cog in a big machine. So 9/11 had the benefit for me of kind of kicking me out and getting me going on that. So over the last 20 years or so, I was part of founding and then building Box of Crayons, which honestly, Richard, started as a solopreneur, me just trying to make a buck, but kind of grew to become this training company with this focus on, as we now say, helping organizations shift from being advice-driven to curiosity-led. And a key offering as part of that is giving managers and leaders practical coaching skills. Mm. About a year and a half ago, I stopped being the CEO there. I stepped away from it. Shannon, one of my colleagues, stepped into the role of CEO, which is so good because she's so much better than I am at being a CEO. I'm quite good at having ideas and creating stuff. I'm thoroughly mediocre as a CEO. So now MBS.works is the new kind of thing that I'm building. Mm-hmm. And its focus is to help people be a force for change in the world. You know, if you're looking to make a difference in your part of the world, if you're looking to give to the world a little bit more than you're taking, then you're the sort of person I'm helping to accelerate that, give you more courage and competence and confidence to step forward and be courageous.
Awesome. And I love that mission, Michael. It's really cool. And I honestly love the material, and I've taken advantage of many of the resources that you have.
Great.
The Year of Living Brilliantly is a wonderful resource for people.
Good, isn't it? I'm really proud of it. I mean, I built it as a kind of marketing tool. If you, in the new book, it's like, come and have this resource. It's a year of teaching, and it's 52 amazing different teachers, and they're diverse and interesting and provocative, and some have beards as good as yours and some don't. But it's a terrible marketing tool, because if what I'm trying to do is get people to come on to my, sign up for my site, and then I can invite them to buy things, and I've kind of gone, you've got a whole year's worth of awesome free content before you'll want to buy anything or engage with me in any other way. So in some ways it's a disaster, but in terms of the kind of the gift to the world, I think it's pretty amazing. There's, 52 pretty cool people involved in that.
Yeah. Well, I do commend you on that. I think it is a wonderful resource, and I hope that you get every kickback eventually that you hoped for. But well, in the meantime, the value is definitely there. I appreciate that.
Part of the luxury I have as a kind of wiring and a belief is I'm much more interested in the impact than the money. I've never been that great at being driven by money. So the fact that we've got, I think it's 5,000 or 6,000 people now going through that, and you got a really active community. And so you see people learning and growing and engaging and supporting each other. It's kind of the reward is there.
Beautiful. Michael, one of the things you've mentioned, and you sort of described the coaching habit, was a bit of a process of several years, and you whittled it down from many questions down to a simple few questions. And then the Advice Trap came out almost exactly, was it exactly 4 years later?
It was exactly 4 years later, because they both got published on the 29th of February.
Yeah, cool. And so it strikes me that there's a bit of a journey in that, in the process of writing those two books. What did you learn and take away from that act of writing books?
Well, there's stuff I already have as a belief around what a good book is. And I think a lot of books in the self-help in the business world, which is kind of where I write, I read much more broadly than that, but I write in those spaces. They're mostly terrible. They're mostly flabby and not that well structured and a bit boring and a bit repetitive and a bit derivative. And so I'm trying to write a book that I want to read. And here's what I want. I want a bit of a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I want a new way of seeing the world, so I get a bit of an aha. I want simplicity on the other side of complexity. So I want you to open up an insight where I'm like, oh, yeah, it takes quite a lot of work to express something as insightfully and clearly as that. And I want it to be the shortest book it can be while still being useful. If you look at the people who I have as role models for book writers, it's people like Seth Godin. He's just got a brand new book out this week or the last couple of weeks. All of his books are short. Austin Kleon, Steal Like an Artist, brilliant book. Edward de Bono from the, I think, the 80s when he was writing, all his books were like, it's one idea in a book. And too many books have too many, they just have too much stuff crammed in them.
Yeah.
It's a classic mistake. It happens all the time in programs and leadership, which is like, let me show you how I'm adding value by giving you more. And so often the value you add is the curation and the discipline to say, I'm giving you the right amount for now.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that in theory, it's hard to do that in practice. You know, if I'm being kind of blunt with myself, I would say, look, The Coaching Habit is a better book than The Advice Trap, because in The Advice Trap, I've just tried to do a little bit too much. And in The Coaching Habit, it's got a leanness, which is beautiful. I mean, I look at that book and I go, it's a really good book. I'll probably never write one quite as elegant as that again, because it's like, it's got a starting point on a chapter on habits. And then it's these seven questions, which, just as you said, I spent a lot of time playing around with how many questions and which questions. They weren't a casual choice at all. And there's a way that that book has an arc to it, which makes it really readable and really useful for people, which is why it sold, you know, nearly a million copies. The Advice Trap, I just tried to do two key things in there, one about advice monsters and one about easy change versus hard change. And they slightly cancel each other out. So it's not, I mean, they're, it's good stuff. It just doesn't quite shine as a book like the Coaching Habit does.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things, as you mentioned, I love about your books is both of them is the simplicity, right? And how immediately applicable the information is. And I personally found it useful to me, not just professionally, but also personally, you know. And I know you've mentioned getting feedback like that in the past. Is that something you were expecting or had foreseen, that it would cross over between professional and personal?
Well, I had a theory about how I was trying to write it, which is I knew I had a very specific person who I was trying to write this for.
Mm-hmm.
It was a senior director or VP. She's a woman. She leads a team. She likes her work. She she's pretty good as a leader, but she's also overwhelmed. She's also a bit frustrated by the team, frustrated about how needy the team is. She's like, how do I work a little less hard? How do I empower my people a little better? How do we have more impact in the work that we do? And she's walking through an airport, because these are in the days when airports existed. And she sees the book and she picks it up and she goes, oh, this is interesting. Oh, as she flips through the pages, I reckon I could read most of this on my next flight. Because, you know, the design of it, there's lots of white space and it's got substance, but it's not overly thick and overwhelming. And she buys it and she goes, this is great. I can use it right away. So I had this really specific person in mind, which is really helpful when you're writing for somebody. But I worked really hard to try and write it in an evergreen way. So it wasn't just about corporations. I hoped it would spread. But, you know, honestly, what you hope for a book and what happens with a book it's about as effective as most 5-year plans. Most 5-year plans are ridiculous. You know, it's like 93% fantasy, 7% delusion, and 6% some other sort of, I don't know, yeah, drug-induced, you know, whatever. Yeah. Most books fail. Most books don't sell many copies. If you're an author and you've sold 10,000 books, you should be thinking to yourself, that's pretty good. 10,000 mm-hmm. books is a lot. Most books sell less than 1,000. To sell over 100,000 copies of a book is like amazing. I mean, honestly, it's not many books sell over 100,000 copies. To get close to a million, you have to have a little sprinkle of fairy dust and good luck to make it happen.
Yeah. Wow. That's really cool. Talking a little bit about coaching, you know, in many ways, coaching seems to be a bit of a dirty word, you know, whether it's because people have negative connotations associated with it, or they misunderstand what it is. Like, how can we as leaders change this stigma?
Well, you're right. I think coaching does come with a lot of baggage associated with it. And it tends to be maybe not quite as divisive as a US election, but it tends to have people on either side of a fence. There are some people who get it and love it and go on about it. And, you know, in some ways their loyalty and belief in coaching is fierce and burns really brightly. There's another group of people, I think probably a larger group of people, who are a bit suspicious about it. It sounds a bit like flavor of the month. It's like, is this just another way of talking about the same old leadership stuff? Is it, you know, maybe this too will pass. And, you know, we'll move on to the next fad. We'll see where that goes and how that works. And, you know, I see it as part of my work to try and unweird coaching for the people who are in that second group. So, to do that, I think you have to understand why people resist coaching. Because if you believe in coaching, you believe it is a bit of a superpower. It's a style of leading that empowers others, increases focus, increases impact. Daniel Goleman did a study from 20 years ago, which is like it has a direct impact on the top line and the bottom line and the corporate culture. And money and culture are the two things that drive an organization. So it's like, why isn't this happening more? That's actually the motivation behind starting Boxer Crayons, which is like, this is good stuff. And yet it's universally struggling to get traction in most organizations. What's that about? I think there are five key reasons people resist coaching. Number one is people go, I don't have time for that stuff. I'm really, really busy. I'm overcommitted. And honestly, my assumption with coaching is it's a 30-minute or 45-minute or an hour-long conversation, because I've seen executive coaches and that's how they run their thing. Or I was in an organization where HR launched, you need to have a monthly coaching call, conversation with your people, and it needs to be an hour long or whatever. And they're like, I just don't have time for that. And I would agree with them. And my stand on it is, if you can't coach in 10 minutes or less, you don't have time to coach.
Mm.
And then the second resistance is people going, Michael, wow, 10 minutes or less, that sounds amazing. I still don't have time to coach. Because if I could coach in 10 minutes or less, I'm booked. Like, I'm just overcommitted. I've got too much stuff. I've got emails that haven't been answered. I've got to-dos that haven't been done. Even if I could coach in 10 minutes or less, I don't have time to add coaching to my current obligations, which are all already manifold and legion. And I would say, again, you are right. If you're looking at coaching as an additive thing to your current obligations, it'll never get done. What I'm trying to teach people is how it can be transformative, how this can be, you do what you currently do, you talk to who you currently talk to, you have the meetings you currently have meetings around, you trade emails in the way that you do, you just make them more coach-like. You add coaching to that current mix. It's not pouring water into an already full glass. It's changing what's in the glass. Then the third resistance, people go, look, okay, that's helpful, but I don't want to be a coach. I mean, I am a, you know, accountant or an engineer or a marketer or a salesperson or a, you know, I've got a career. I'm a professional. I'm trying to do my thing. I don't want to be a coach. I've met coaches, not my people. And I'm like, excellent, because we have lots of coaches, and I don't want you to be a coach either. I want you to be you in your role, whether that's senior, whether you're a mid-level manager, whether you're an individual contributor, you who is more coach-like. Like, oh, coach-like. For some people, this is a very liberating moment where they're like, you're not turning me into a coach. You're just helping me be a coach-like leader, coach-like manager. Great, they go. And then they go, Could we define terms? This is the fourth resistance. I'm not sure what we're even talking about, because it's true. There are, you type in what is coaching, there's a bazillion slightly confusing, slightly contradictory definitions. You know, is it sports coaching? Is it life coaching? Is it youth coaching? Is it ADHD coaching? Is it executive coaching? And then each company that teaches coaching has their own definition because it's intellectual property. So you got all of that going on as well. And then each company has its own model. So some are stars and some are circles and some are squares and some are squiggly lines. And it's like, okay, what is coaching? So here's my definition. Very behavior-based. It's this. Can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving a little bit more slowly? Now people go, oh, okay, so it's not a big thing and it's not a mysterious black box. It's just, can you stay curious a little bit longer? Because curiosity is the core behavior, the superpower that rests behind coaching. Coaching is one manifestation, or being coach-like is one manifestation of that. Then people go, all right, so you seem to have made coaching feel less weird. It's not about taking lots of time. It's about making it part of my everyday working life. I realize I can be more coach-like with anybody, with my direct reports or my colleagues, my peers, a vendor, a random person on the street. But then they kind of go, but you know, what's in it for me? Because it's not easy to change your behavior. It's not easy to do things differently. And you're asking me to move from giving more advice and being more directive to stepping back from that and being curious. And that's not an easy transformation. Why would I do that hard work to do that change? And my answer to that is, look, odds are that you'll get to work a little less hard and you'll get to have more impact in the work that you do. Because in that act of being more coach-like, you're more likely to find the real things to be working on. So you're really targeted on the stuff that matters. And you're more likely to be generating better ideas and better solutions. And you're more likely to be building a team that's more competent and confident and autonomous and self-sufficient and all of that good stuff. And if you've got a team that's more autonomous, more focused on the stuff that matters, generating better ideas so you get better solutions to solve the real challenges, well, then everybody's going to win from that, including you, because you're having more impact whilst working a little less hard. That's a very long answer, I know.
No, but you know what? It really illuminates it because, and I mean, I'm a huge believer in coaching, and I've always appreciated having a coach, being a coach, you know, and the impact that it can have in someone's life, whether it's mine or someone else's. Right. So, you know, to me, you're preaching to the choir, and I just I hope this is hitting home for the listener because
right.
how important it is.
Yeah, I mean, the people like you, Rashad, who are like, I'm already there. I'm already sold. I'm like, that's awesome. But I'm not really talking to you because you've already got a kind of commitment to it. And I'm actually not talking to the people who might be listening, probably not many of these people, but who are kind of skeptical of this whole thing. They're like, coaching, it's a load of old hoo-ha. I'm really trying, the people who I'm most interested in kind of getting interested, those people in the middle who are like, I've been burnt a little bit by coaching before. I've tried it once or twice. It hasn't stuck. Seems like a lot of noise and a bit of a distraction. And I'm just a regular person trying to do a regular job. Those are the people who I'm like, give this another chance. Find a way to make coaching an everyday way of leading. Lead with curiosity. As Rashad said, you know, the Coaching Habit book, it's like 7 good questions. And honestly, you don't even need all 7. Take 5. Take 3. Move into this world with a palette of 3 really good questions that you think can help you, and you'll find the way that you lead changes.
Yeah. Yeah. You've referred a couple times already to the terms that you use, advice-driven, curiosity-led. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack those concepts a little bit and talk about the transition to curiosity?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, advice-driven people get it in theory and they'll get the experience. Because when I describe it to you, most people will go, that's remarkably familiar. It's that moment when somebody starts talking to you, particularly somebody on your team, you know, committed to doing the work that you are all engaged in. And they come up to you and they go, hey, Michael, how do I? And you're like, oh, this is amazing. And before you know it, you're telling them stuff. Or even, you know, they don't ask you directly for help, but they come into your office, whether that's, you know, through Zoom and virtual or whether you're in an actual office, and they start talking about the thing that they're up against. And after about 10 seconds, you kind of stop listening to them because you already have an idea and you're just waiting for them to shut up so that you can tell it to them. That's advice driven. And there's all sorts of really good reasons for that. The most obvious being we've been encouraged and rewarded and marked all our life for having answers, for having the ideally the right answers. So you've been trained to prove your value by having this solution. And it's just not as successful a strategy as we'd all like to believe. Because here's what happens when you leap in and you start solving things too quickly. There are three possible points of entrapment. One is you're solving the wrong problem, because almost never is the first challenge somebody brings you the real challenge or the most significant challenge. But even if it is, even if they've come to you with a perfectly crisp, deeply articulated, thoughtful description of here's the challenge and here's what's really the challenge for me. Secondly, your solutions and your answers just aren't nearly as good as you think they are. They come with your own biases and your own limited experience. And your brain is wired to convince you that your answers are excellent. But your brain is a liar. Your brain is like, it's a cognitive bias. You know, read Thinking Fast and Slow if you want to deep dive into what that's about. But Rashid, even if you've got a brilliant insight on what the problem really is and a brilliant idea on how to fix it, the third challenge is, well, the third question to ask yourself is, what's the best act of leadership for me right now? Is it to provide the answer? And honestly, sometimes that is the right act of leadership. Or is it to just hold your tongue a bit and allow that other person to do some work to see if she can make progress and she can figure some of this stuff out? And most of the time, you can wait a little bit longer. But most of us are advice driven. And by driven, you've got that kind of crack and whip that you just have this habit of leaping into advice.
Mm-hmm.
And curiosity is a way of counteracting those three points of vulnerability. You're more likely to figure out what the real challenge is, particularly when you ask a question as obvious as, okay, so what's the real challenge here now for you? You're more likely to generate ideas and possibilities rather than getting seduced into thinking the first idea and the first solution is the best one. Almost never is. And in that act of leadership, you are more likely to invite people forward to be the best version of themselves, to hold the accountability and responsibility that's theirs to hold. What are those things that you hope for as a leader?
And as you pointed out, like, you know, giving advice is not always a bad thing, right? Sometimes it's the needed thing, but like, I don't know if there's a scientific answer or if it's really a formula or anything like that, but like, how do you figure out giving the advice or not, or asking the question?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. The first is to become aware of what your default is. That's really helpful. My default, because I've been practicing for years, because this is kind of what I've been preaching for years, is to never give the answer, to always try and avoid the answer being the first thing. And if your default is to ask a question, what happens if you ask a question and that they really want the answer? They're like, I don't want any of your questions. Just tell me where the folder is. So just understanding where your default setting lies, and know that for almost everybody, it's into advice giving, and actually much more than you realize. It's more than you'd be surprised at how often you're out there offering up ideas, opinions, solutions, advice. The second thing to do is potentially be lazy. And this is a bit more of a kind of advanced skill. But one of the things that I found really helpful for me when I'm trying to be more coach-like is, if I've got a question in my head about how this is going or what should I be doing, I stop trying to solve it in my own head and I put it on the table and I ask us to solve it rather than me to solve it. So if you come to me and I'm like, oh, I'm not sure whether I should give you the my opinion or whether I should ask a question and see if you can figure it out for yourself, what I may well end up doing is going, hey, Richard, I'm not sure whether I've got an idea. It came right to my mind straight away. But I'm just wondering whether the best thing to do is just give you what I think so you go away and act on it, or whether we should just have a quick conversation to see if we can figure this out together and see what ideas you've already got on how to tackle this. And now it's a shared decision and a shared responsibility, and actually even asking it out loud, I'm like, I'm just going to ask him some questions. Who am I kidding? I'm not going to give him the answer. So there's that. So I think that's the second thing you can do. People carry a degree of anxiety about what happens if I ask a question and it's like they don't have time for it, or it's not a very good question, or a waste time. And I think coaching might feel like it takes more time than giving advice. But if you realize that so often when you give advice, you give the wrong advice to solve the wrong problem in a way that only encourages them to come back to you and ask for more advice for more problems, and you realize the cumulative effect of all the time that all of that takes to untangle and unpick, you discover that spending that 2 minutes up front asking a couple of questions and having them have the aha pays huge dividends pretty quickly, rather than them coming back the next day going, yeah, I tried your idea, it didn't work. Now what should I do? And you're like, oh, now you're carrying the weight of the responsibility. Now you're disempowering them. Now they're actively engaged to help you disempower them. Very frustrating.
Wow, yeah. And, you know, like the default that you refer to, you know, like I think I'm getting better, but, you know, my default has definitely been the tell it monster. And I mean, thought I was more so a save it, but I took your questionnaire on you know, over there, and it came and said, as I'm a tell it. And I can see that, because it's the default to like provide the answers and the solutions and the ideas and all that thing. And it's like, you know, it's, you know, for the self-awareness people, concept. Yeah. Correct.
Self-awareness is it. And, you know, if people are wondering what Rashad's talking about, you know, in the newer book, The Advice Trap, there are these three different advice monsters: tell it, save it, and control it. And at theadvicetrap.com, we have a free questionnaire that people can take. It's, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes maximum. It's like 20 questions. And it will give you an indication of which of those three is your preference, is your kind of default response. And, you know, it's a questionnaire that I wrote and built out. So in no way is this like scientific or rigorous or something that you need to put on your LinkedIn resume. It's there to provoke a response. And actually, I love what you said, which is like, oh, I thought I was this. This questionnaire says that. If what that does is it opens up more self-awareness about how you're showing up, then its job is done. That's perfect. I'm less interested in the label. I'm more interested in the opportunity it gives you to generate that cycle of self-awareness.
Yeah. And, you know, I love it because it is an opportunity for self-awareness and knowing myself a little bit more. Right. You know, a recent episode of mine, I spent a bit of time talking about knowing oneself and the Socrates quote, to know thyself is the beginning of wisdom. Yeah. And, you know, how the better you know yourself, the more effective you can be as a leader and as a human being.
Right.
And so, you know, this is another element of it for me, and my journey is knowing where I sit on, you know, do I default to ask a question and coach, or do I default and try to instantly give that answer and solution? So it's an interesting dynamic to become aware of.
Yeah, exactly. And that's self-awareness. You know, if you know what your patterns are, if you know how you behave, you can then work with people to manage that and give yourself just the best chance of mitigating that while playing into some of the strengths that you have as well.
Hmm. You know, little bit of a question on the same subject, but because we are, if you're listening to this and it's November 2020 is what it is right now. It's actually Remembrance Day today. Mm-hmm. And if we look across Canada and a lot of, you know, the world right now, we're still struggling with a worldwide pandemic, people figuring out how to work from home, and all these kind of issues that go along with that. So more people than ever are working remotely. And I'm interested to know, Michael, how this affects coaching and advice-giving dynamics and what leaders need to be aware of dealing with remote teams.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's worth talking to the context of 2020 as a stressful year. You know, pandemic, obviously, the pressure the economies are under and will continue to be under. So, you know, certainties and uncertainties for people around their jobs, the whole US election, which no matter whether you live in the US or not, has ripples of anxiety going out across the world. So I know, you know, Canada, we spend a lot of time looking down at the US going, what the heck is going on down there? And just, you know, feeling like that's the brokenness of that country is particularly apparent right now. And what that means, what does that mean to us as Canadians and what us as global citizens? So it's just a bunch of stuff that is hard. And I don't have kids. I'm happily child-free. So I don't even have the next level of awareness of what does it mean to be schooling and raising kids and being locked in a house with your spouse for 9 months or whatever it might be. So all of that to say, at times of uncertainty, our brain encourages us to find certainty all the time because our brains don't like uncertainty and it does like certainty. It's just a kind of very deep, very primitive wiring. You know, the brain is there to keep us safe, keep us alive. And so it constantly scans the environment going, is it safe here or is it dangerous? And one of the ways it decides whether it's safe or dangerous is, do I know what's about to happen or not know? So just extended uncertainty is exhausting for your brain, which is why we're all a bit kind of on edge. It's useful just to acknowledge that and to acknowledge the pressure our brain is under on a kind of conscious and unconscious level to create more certainty. And that can feel like giving more advice, offering up more solutions. I don't have a magic formula or a magic mix here, but I will say that it's as important as ever to stay curious, because if your drive for certainty is driven by your kind of the panic of your brain, that's probably not helping you. And the certainty you're getting to is illusory. At a more tactical level, you know, people ask all the time, well, you know, I'm running a remote team now. How do I coach? At Box of Crayons, when we talk about coaching, we say there are three principles: be lazy, be curious, be often. So being curious, we've talked about a lot, which is like the power of questions. Being lazy speaks to that foundational piece of don't stop saving people. Stop doing other people's work for them. If it's their challenge to figure out, ask the questions that allow them to figure out the challenge rather than giving them the advice and solving it for them. Mm-hmm. But of the three, I think the more radical or most radical, though it doesn't necessarily sound it, is the last one, which is be often. And here's what I mean. Be often says any interaction you have with somebody can be more coach-like. So it really goes contrary to where sometimes coaching is put, which is it's an occasional formal interaction. Hey, come into my office. It's our monthly coaching session. That's not where I stand at all. I'm like, every interaction can be more coach-like. And when we can make this podcast more coach-like than people have had before. It's like this, you know, listen to the conversation we've had, and we've been going for about 45 minutes. What's been most useful or most valuable here for you so far? You know, this is the learning question, the seventh question of the book in The Coaching Habit. What's been most useful or most valuable here for you? And if you're listening and you've heard me say that, and you actually stop and just reflect back and reflect on the things I've said and Shad said, you'll find one or two things surfaces, actually ones that struck a chord for you. They're like, oh yeah, those things. By asking you that, by asking you to name it and claim it as this is the thing that's been most useful, I've just given you a better chance of it sticking, because you've had to do the work to figure it out and say, this is the label I'm giving that. And, you know, if you really want to do something awesome, now you go to the testimonial review section on Apple Podcasts, and you give this show a rating, going, look, 5 stars, awesome show, and here's the thing I learned from the great episode with Michael, and you just type out what you learned. But I've made this experience just a tiny bit more coach-like by asking that question to the audience. So I don't know who's listening. I don't know when they're listening. I don't know what their answer is. But I can be more coach-like by asking a question that invites them in to take ownership of their own learning and encourages them to get smarter by making new neural connections.
I think that is possibly the most powerful thing for me in this conversation. You know, and the illustration that you've made of making this conversation more coach-like. So I truly appreciate that power of that, Michael. Thank you.
My pleasure.
With respect to our time coming to an end here, I will forego a couple of questions, but...
I know, I talk too much. I'm sorry about that. I get kind of excited and a bit soapboxy about it all.
Not at all. I think that there's been a great deal of information. I always have to come back and re-listen to my recording so that I can digest it and absorb it for myself.
Sure.
So our final couple of questions, and then we'll give you an opportunity to plug your books and website.
Sure.
But what is one thing you know about life or leadership that you wish everyone knew?
That we exist in a complex system rather than a complicated system. Complicated system works on the assumption that, you know, if you build it and then you press the lever, the thing you're hoping for pops out the other end. Complex is when you recognize that when you take an action, it's unclear what the reaction is necessarily going to be about that, and that our lives and leadership within that lives is emergent. And the way that you operate in that space is not by rules, but by principles. Complicated systems love rules. That's bureaucracy. It's like, first this happens, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. When you're operating in a complex system, where things are difficult and some are wicked and it's not always easy to know what to do, having 2 or 3 or 4 core principles or values, like this is how I show up, gives you a better way of navigating through that space. So life is complex, and that's a good thing.
Cool. When it's all said and done, Michael, what 3 words do you want to be used to describe your life?
Here are my 3 words. I don't care. Because I am not that interested or concerned about my legacy, because I can't do much about it. You know, I remember going to a museum in Istanbul and seeing some amazing Ming china that had somehow survived the trip from China to Turkey, had survived assorted revolutions, had survived the rise and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, and somehow was pristine and on display. I'm like, that's amazing. Particularly when you think of how much pottery was produced by the Ming dynasty and how much just got broken or lost or chipped or thrown away. Odds are that, you know, in 100 years, definitely in 200 years, nobody will know who I am. Nobody will read my books, if books even exist. I'll have just vanished. So my job is to be as courageous as I can in what I take on and the work that I do. I'm trying to find that work that challenges me. There's a Rilke poem called The Man Standing where he says, look, it's not the winning is nothing. Winning just makes you small. It is the victory is taking on ever greater defeats. And I love that. That's what I want. I want to keep going up against it, going, you know, as in the poem, he's wrestling with the angel, like Jacob and the angel in the Bible. I'm like, I want a series of ever greater defeats. And I want to feel nourished and fulfilled in myself. I want to feel like I'm giving the work I do every chance of success and making a difference in this world. And I also know what I can control and what I can influence and what I can neither control nor influence. And how people speak about me is entirely their choice.
You know, I think that's an incredible answer and very different to what most people would say, but also very insightful. So thank you for sharing that, Michael.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Really appreciate you being on the show with me today. What a great conversation. Really appreciate it. Why don't you tell us where people can connect with you?
Yeah, sure. So look, if you're interested in any of the books, well, booksellers, independent online sellers, Amazon, of course, as well, The Coaching Habit and The Advice Draft are the two most recent. I wrote one called 10 years ago called Do More Great Work, which is about how do you figure out the work that has more impact and more meaning. So that might be interesting for some folks. If you're looking for a more immediate hit, what we talked about before at the start, The Year of Living Brilliantly, you can just access that at mbs.works. That's the website URL, mbs.works. And it's totally free, 52 weeks, great teachers, great community. So it's really something interesting happening there. And then I don't spend a lot of time on social media, but you know, if you can follow me on LinkedIn, you can just find me by typing my name in, or on Instagram at mbs_works.
Awesome. I'll make sure to get all those links in the show notes over at rashadoberlander.com. Check it out there. And once again, Michael, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Rashad. Thanks for having me.
If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, would you head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe, leave me a rating, leave me a review, and share this with a friend. It spreads the word and helps the podcast grow. You can also find me on social media at R.E. Oberlander. Until next time, stay awesome.